Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents 381 by Aaliyah Whiteley, narrated by Justine Eyre. Archive. Personal project per 596-837-58. Introduction, footnotes, and conclusion by Rowena Savalas. 7 January 2314. We have yet to reach perfection, but many think we are close. Anon. I remember the first time I dreamed all the numbers had disappeared. Instead of organization, there was an insurmountable heap of life, piled higher than the sky, vast enough to swamp what we have achieved. The Magna Man method was lost, buried. Nothing of our time and place, not even the Unity Spire, emerged from that squirming mountain. I jerked awake, lay in bed, breathing. A profound feeling swept through my limbs, my stomach, my soft, living brain. Gratitude, and then sympathy. Sympathy for those who tried to make sense of their own short lives during the age of humanity that preceded our own, the age of riches. It's difficult to come to terms with what humanity once was. The future is clear and calm, a long, straight road ahead, and challenges that once plagued us are now overcome. There is only the past left to fear, and I found it easy to picture the old ways as a monster coming up fast behind me. How can I learn to accept this terrible legacy? Not only that, how can I be honest about what price we continue to pay to escape it? When we sacrificed difference and discord, we gave up on part of ourselves. It takes bravery to admit that maybe we miss it. That's why I have started this personal project. Firstly, a bit about me. I am Rowena Savalas. If you are discovering this document for some future personal project of your own, hello, I'm waving at you. Both hands. I live in the age of curation, which commenced with the global adoption of the Magna Man method in 2168. To quote Magna Man, we already had the answers. We needed better questions. There was no problem facing humanity to which we had not already found a solution, one that invariably had been obscured under useless detritus masquerading as information for the sake of profit, personal ease, or cruelty. Magna Man's techniques allowed us to interrogate and classify such motives, and to allow the true jewels of our time to shine forth. We apply them still to every document created. They saved our present, and at the same time created our future, for they revealed what had been hidden. Stream existence was already with us, and trying to hide from human destructive capabilities, much like every other creature on the planet. That realization changed the world. That was not an easy process. Footnote 1. Understatement. Many documents have been created that go through the formation of the Unity process. I recommend starting with Magna Man's own titles 1 through 62, then a wide search in UNI 11231111. But once we learned to nurture, more than that, to cooperate, we discovered a way of incorporating the vast wisdom of the streams into the delight and discovery of organic living. From a different angle, what am I? I am organic. I am part of the Atlantic settlements on the reclaimed Jurassic coast. I am 17 years of age in body and 663 in streaming years. I feel I need to make sense of both sides of myself. You know how sometimes you want answers that don't come out of knowledge, but from the struggle of emotions inside you? Part of it is that I haven't decided on a life path yet. I think maybe I want to be a historian, so I hope this project will help me decide if that's right for me. I feel it is important to make a good job of this. I'm not sure who gets to be the judge of whether I achieve that. Enough about me. If you opened this document because of the title, then you probably want to read about the Age of Riches. You've come to the right place. It's a personal obsession of mine. Here's what we think we know. lasting from the end of the 20th century to the beginning of the 22nd century, the age of riches is defined as an intense and consuming explosion of digital information that could be characterized as a sweeping mania and has been called the first global movement, although it would bring no unity of purpose. The rise of instantaneous communication, coupled with a period of general deregulation in areas such as trade, travel, and, crucially, information. Did these things lie at the heart of that wild time? It seems like an easy generalization. Let's start again. The Age of Riches is a unique challenge. Previous eras have been studied in an entirely different way. What evidence remains? Asked the historians of the past. They found what physical confirmation they could by digging up objects, reading the scanned written record, inevitably littered with the bias of the victor or the privileged, cherishing whatever had survived down the centuries. They studied exhaustively, then extrapolated. Every crumb was a gem. In the age of riches, there are simply too many crumbs to find value in them all. In fact, the sheer amount of data is its own worst enemy. Vast amounts of data were taken and stored about every person. Thoughts noted, measurements taken, motives ascribed. At the same time, old methods of cataloging and classification were simply not up to the task of keeping that data accessible. I think I can explain it better like this. In the Bronze Age, a dull rock would have been mined, its potential visible to those trained in such an art. The rock would be cut, then polished to a shine, and the shiny jewel would be set in a crown. The archaeologist skilled or lucky enough to find it would have seen its status to its contemporaries. In the Age of Riches, all rocks were deemed to be equally polishable, and therefore no rocks were worthy of polishing. They were people of a time that had everything and valued nothing. The task of the modern historian, then, begins with assigning worth by digging through the mountain of digital items that nobody rated to begin with. Traditional measurements of metadata must be treated with absolute suspicion. Do we consider a source to be personal or public, fictitious or real, important or trivial? All lines are blurred. It's a thrilling process. Am I capable of doing it justice? Would it be a good way to spend this short, fleshy life? And so, too, the Dance of the Horned Road. On 23rd July 2024, roughly 5 quintillion bytes of digital data were created. Footnote 2. Estimate taken from Fallen Riches, The Unconquerable Mountain, Dr. Weatherby, YY, PP 1468, curated by Creation Holdings Association, AOR 600-3005. Documents came into being and were circulated instantly with little metadata beyond the time and place of upload. Some were viewed by millions, some by only a handful. The Dance of the Horned Road was released on that day. The metadata that remains tells us it was labeled as an autobiographical document containing elements of fiction, but much of it makes no sense when viewed alongside other documents of that period. It's possible that the document was given a physical manifestation. Printed materials do exist from that time, although that does not guarantee meaning or importance. This document is not obviously special or of interest. It holds no value beyond what we might individually assign to it. But it fascinates me. I came across it by accident, but there's a part of me that wants to think of it as fate. I know, ridiculous. But it's hard to understand otherwise. I've long had a game that I play at the end of long days, when I can't sleep for fear of dreaming. I follow metadata from one document to the next, choosing a word at random, looking for documents that have been barely touched by the sifting process, which is, I believe, the great work of our age. I've uncovered the strangest things that way. Images you wouldn't believe with your own eyes. Stories that hardly make sense. The Dance of the Horned Road came to me that way, a truly random discovery. I read the first words with mild curiosity, And then I began to get sucked into the story, because it connected with me in a way that's difficult to explain in words. It's the tale of a young woman who doesn't know what to do with her life. She is given a quest that makes no sense. She is unshaped, undiscovered, unappreciated, in the way only a character from the Age of Riches can't be. I knew I'd found something special, not to the world, but to me. So here I am, at this moment, polishing her. She is, at least to me, a shining jewel. This document, which I will annotate with my thoughts and perceptions, reads like a puzzle that begs to be solved, but is determined to skip all the juicy clues. It makes little sense. It doesn't conform to any logic but its own. Things happen that could not possibly happen, and have meanings we could not possibly follow. The streaming side of me sees data, links and lines and numbers. Well, one number, but it can't make purpose from that. I think only my humanity can provide a reason for this dance. Romantic, I know, but aren't all quests on the romantic side? I asked myself the same question over and over while reading. What does this all mean? I'm beginning to think that's the wrong question to ask. What questions should I ask of it, and of that long-ago time that remains so well hidden under a wealth we cannot value? This is what lies at the heart of this personal project, and I hope, by the end, to have an answer. The Dance of the Horned Road. The start. The rules, the lake, the mountain, the breathing man, the others, the factory, the hotel, the pub, the spire, the doctor, the breathing man, the char, the cave of teeth, the forest, the twin towns, the breathing man, the boat, the pavilion, the forever, the farm, the swamp, the camper van, the statue, the mud, the breathing man, the tunnel, the walkway, the snack shack, the balloon, the waiting room, the long room, the queue, the robot, the decision, the rocket, the old friend, the breathing man, the meeting, the escape pod, the return, the heads, the switch, the escape, the start. Footnote 3. Are these chapter headings or a possible corruption of rudimentary digital metadata? There's no author name, although the document is tagged as both autobiography and travelogue, so it seems acceptable to use fairly as the name of the creator, but with wariness. After all, other tags applied to the document include fantasy, science fiction, and adventure. Were they given at the time? Who decides when a document earns certain tags? Fairly found herself at the start of the Horned Road. She had been daydreaming of not having to be the one who still waited, to be the one that time moved for. She couldn't remember the choice, the urge to walk, to end up here. She knelt and touched the surface. She had always assumed it was made of cobbles, small bulges of stone on their way to being worn smooth. But they were cold to the touch, and she wondered, were they made of some other material? Glass, perhaps? Or perhaps the cobbles, bunched and black, were warty growths on the back of a vast animal, a serpent, or something with horns? How else would the road get its name? To walk on the back of a creature to whom she was no more than a tickle, a sliver of awareness, was that her fate? This was it, the beginning of her adventure. Fairly had first heard of the walking of the Horned Road at a party, a friend's birthday when she was very young. The friend was called Cecile, and she'd been newly 8, puffed up in a fresh pink dress. Cecile had been given a backpack, delicate, woven, with a picture of a rocket embroidered upon it, as a present from her parents, and when Fairly asked why, Cecile had replied, "For my quest." "Wealth makes things move in the easiest direction," Fairly's mother had told her later that evening, after the party had ended. They had wealth, she realised, and her mother spoke from experience somehow. Their house was large, and the feeling of financial comfort was a blanket over their casual movements, their languid goodnights. Her mother worked as a speaker. It was a lucrative position that came with respect, although Fairley hadn't realised that, and had thought there was some special light inside her mother that made others look at her with veiled, grateful eyes. Later that month, a storyteller had appeared at Fairley's own birthday party. He had worn a colourful, swirling cloak and had danced as he spoke, and she had swallowed every word like cake, her friends too, sitting in a ring around him. He had spoken of the road and of adventures that awaited the brave, the chosen few. 381. "How do I get chosen?" Fairley had asked the storyteller as he was packing away his cloak after the show. The other children had been playing a game, the tale already absorbed and accepted. The storyteller had shrugged, then said,
"The time comes when the moment comes, and then you know, or something."
She had been thinking about it since, picturing some wonderful revelation, a world of sky-high starbursts and inner delight. Not a second like any other, one she couldn't pick out of the crowd. But when it came down to it, she had not been chosen at all. She had simply opted to make her way there. Now, in the aftermath of choice, it was time to make her way back and reveal what had happened. She straightened and took a long look at the way the road began and ended at her village. It contained everything she knew, but from this perspective it was only an enclosed space between the thick wooden walls of a stockade. Footnote 4. Fairley lives in a walled village, which doesn't fit with what we think we know of the age. Why would her group, in particular, have isolated themselves in this way? Not only to be alone inside their heads, but from the whole world? Could there have been many of these groups that simply appear to be invisible to the stream now, looking back at the age because they were not represented digitally? See, information poverty, isolationism. With a gate that opened in the morning and closed at night, inside there were people so familiar to her that she did not even consider them to be separate from her own life. The mothers and fathers and children that had aged with her, and yet who never changed, never talked to her in anything but the same tone of voice. Her mother was a speaker. Their house was the heart of the village, of course. The tasks, the buildings, the ground, the stream, the late-night gatherings for kind and social words, and the midday calls to the big hall for different words, words of business. The study was quiet. It was a rare moment of peace, with the chime on the desk silent, as if the world knew to hold its breath. "I've been chosen," Fairley told her mother, who cried a little and laughed and took charge with energy of preparations. No fake little bag with embroidery for Fairley. Her mother drew out a sturdy canvas backpack with a small tent and a sleeping bag fitted, and a cooking pot and supplies attached to the base. Footnote 5. The backpack is hard to picture. How much weight can one human being carry? Maybe it's metaphorical. But I did find, through the stream, a document from the same period entitled "The Backpacker's Buddy, A Guide to Essential Packing for the Committed Rambler." Author L.G. Vey, C. Vey, 968-588-89. Mainly it was formulated of anecdotes and nonsensical stories involving taking on bears and drinking one's own urine. But there was an extensive list of items that every backpacker should carry. This has been attached as Appendix A.
"It was my own," said her mother, and they hugged. "A gift for a gift," said her mother. "That's the way to begin."
381. The departure lounge was empty, apart from Fairley, alone, scared. Her friends and family had only just waved her off and filed out. The mayor said,
"Get cracking," with a wide smile. "It's the best way. Hit the road early, move those feet."
So she had wished her mother goodbye, big hug.
"You'll be back before you know it, and you'll be all grown up, a hero." and the others dispensed their own wisdom, then disbanded. She swallowed and swallowed. The fruitcake, specially cooked for the occasion by the village baker, had been very dry, and she hadn't wanted to wash it down with fizzy wine so early in the adventure. A clear head might well be needed for these first steps. The departure lounge was in the village hall, which was the first and last building by the gate. It was a large, untidy room that she'd always taken for granted, having attended many of these leaving events. And returns, too, questers looking tired, grimy, spent, older. Not everyone returned. She had asked her mother once, "What happens to the ones that don't return?" And her mother had said, "Not all roads lead back to the beginning." Quests were a funny business. Footnote 6. Quest narratives are well established throughout earlier ages, and it is possible to make the assumption that a familiarity would be expected, although whether it would be on a fictional or non-fictional basis is not known. Did everyone have a quest? How did these get allocated? There's plenty of evidence showing a wealth of quest expectations made, often directly upon the young, in both real, fantastical terms, adding to the element of peril. What are the actual expectations here? Goals, attainment, wealth? These all appear in the document, and within life in the age of riches. In all ages before this one, really. All the more so for being given as gifts to those who were actually being asked, when she thought about it, to give up things. Destiny was different. Destiny was an idea that fairly decided she liked. She gave it to herself, a destiny. She wanted to find importance in being alive and in walking the horned road. Let it lead where it would. There were three things that now needed to happen. It was the way of the quest. Fairly did them with a sense of ceremony, even though there was nobody there to see it but herself. She took a mental picture of herself, to cherish later when things got tough. She took the three char that had been laid out on the table for her, next to the unappetizing cake. She put them in the central pocket of her dungarees. She picked up her inherited backpack and put it on. It was heavy. It contained objects that clunked, then settled into the shape of her back. Then she thought about pressing the chain device. 381. The mayor always gave the same speech at leaving events. Fairly had thought repetition had rendered the words toothless, but for her own departure they had bitten hard.
"Here in this land we know heroes by their actions, so we ask our young ones, the ones who dream, to complete a quest. The quest is as follows. Press the button that sits atop every chain device in this land. You will be given three char. Use them wisely. You will be followed by the breathing man. You will find the way hard and long, and you will know your place when you are done."
The device sat in the corner of the conference room. It was a large silvery box, and it was without adornment. A big red button sat in the centre of the top panel. The box looked very solid to her, as if she couldn't have picked it up, so she was glad that wasn't part of the challenge. Footnote 7. The poetic structure. I love it. I think it assumes, on the reader's part, a knowledge of traditional epics told in many languages. I've read a lot of epics. They're the best. The setting of goals ties strongly into earlier incarnations of quest narratives, but is quickly undercut by the subsequent introduction of a machine, both mechanical and allegorical, a literal device. See documents on the fractious relationship between science and magic under SMG 394-85555. She wasn't strong, and she was only pretending to be brave. She already knew that. She didn't think this was necessarily a drawback to completing a quest, and perhaps it was a benefit. It gave her room to grow, and she had to start doing that by finding the courage to press the button. Fairly had never seen anyone press the button. This part was done alone, always. It had occurred to her that maybe the box was capable of bestowing judgment and carrying out an instant sentence. Could it possibly zap those questers it decided could not possibly succeed? Disintegrate them somehow so there weren't even tiny pieces left? But no, surely the village wouldn't allow that to happen. She had faith in their protection of her, at least while she remained within the boundaries. Footnote 8. The mechanical then gives way to the magical. Here we go. Her legs felt as if they would barely hold her up, but she managed to walk up to the chain device and press the button. And at first it seems as though nothing has happened. But then I realise that the room has changed colour, just a little, shifting into brightness it did not possess before. I am braver. I see the world afresh because I am a little taller, my eyes a little clearer. This quest is off to a magnificent start. 381. The feeling makes it easy to walk the first mile. Footnote 9. The function of the device is to change awareness, represented by a shift in person and or tense. Did such devices have a real-life counterpart, and a literary switch represents some version of their function? Consciousness-altering objects could well have existed, although nothing like what we know today, and possibly without proper protection principles. A first hint of a perilous puzzle, this quest? Streaming without safety? But the stakes are so much higher. One life, one body. So romantic. The day is humid, and my stomach is full with dry cake. I know what the chain devices look like, and I will find them all. Oh, yes, I will find them all. I want to be more than I am. I want to be everything to everyone. I want everyone to like me, and I don't see why that's impossible. I'll win the heart of every single person I come across on this quest. The horned road is following the line of the hills. I know this direction will lead me to the city eventually. I visited it once or twice with my mother when she was attending training courses for her job as a speaker. I'll make the city and all that lies beyond it love me. I think of Cecile. She set out on her own quest over a year ago. She was always more mature than I, although only weeks separated our birth dates. She led the way and I followed, in taste, in clothes, in sipping beer behind the village hall, in dancing without music, working out routines, trying to look like we didn't care if anyone watched. She hasn't yet returned. I dream for a while about meeting her on the horned road and the two of us returning together in victory, in knowledge. Be every bit the hero you can be, my mother says on the chime to those who call in need of her help. Only those on a quest are allowed to use the horned road. I won't meet anybody else, the kind of people who have made up my life so far, and that makes these first steps a lonely business. But I know if I continue in this direction, it won't be long until I reach the lake. I think about it as I take those first steps, beginning to feel the inescapable weight of the backpack. I will arrive and see it, and it will sparkle in the sunshine, and it will be long and cool and deep and perfect, and this walk uphill is tiring, and the cobbles of the road are slippery under the soles of my new boots, and I crest the first big hill and see. 381. I swim in the lake. Footnote 10. Another data corruption? The abrupt end of the previous section might suggest as much, but the regularity and length of every section remains unbroken. Here's an interesting fact. Every section of the document is precisely 381 words in length. That's the same number that appears in every gap in the narrative. According to the Magna Man method, documents tagged with 381 are business, corporate, economic, legacy. 381.381381381 is the tag for philosophical and ethical principles of defunct economic models. Not really relevant. Cross-referenced within the age of riches, 381 was a cyber expression with the meaning of, I love you. Three words, eight letters, one meaning. That's wonderful, isn't it? A number as an outpouring of love. The lake isn't cool.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?